Well, if you're reasonably situated and reasonably comfortable, let us begin this afternoon's session, which means you can roll the tape over there. I love doing that. Every time doing that. And there's a few faces here that I don't recognize. I know a lot of folks came in just recently, so I will go through all the preliminaries since I have to anyway. I'm Charles Lane. And the title of the session this week, Earthwatch, Cadillac Desert. And I assume that you all came in hoping that maybe there'd be a certain ambience that we'd have since it's been so cold here lately and in a discussion of the Cadillac Desert. But for a brief introduction, I'll tell you that I've come a certain distance here to be at Holden this summer. I'm the chairman of the Department of Geology at a place called Hardin-Simmons University, which is in Abilene, Texas. It is a liberal arts university affiliated with the Southern Baptist Church, which leaves me as a Lutheran kind of on the outside looking in from time to time in terms of how things go on down there. And director of the university's Natural Resources Institute, my principal interest is in water resource issues. And my professional interests then fall into hydrology. And wanted to chat with you a little bit this afternoon about the Cadillac Desert. Who's heard the name before you saw it on the board? Tell us about it.
Well, I know there's a book that's been written on it. That's all I know.
Right. Right. And nobody else is... This was news to you to see this up on the board. All right, here's a small attempt at awakening the ecological conscience within you. The term Cadillac Desert has been with us for about 6 years. It first came out in 1986 in a book that is entitled Cadillac Desert, The American West and Its Disappearing Water. And the author is named Reisner, R-E-I-S-N-E-R. The book can be obtained from Viking Press out of New York. And a very catchy title that has since found its way into other books and into other circles, as a matter of fact. I suspect if you listen for it from now on, you'll actually catch the term in other situations, other places, the term Cadillac Desert. And it's a story of the American West. And I suspect that we have, for the most part, Westerners, we have our Duluth connection. Anybody farther east than Duluth? From where?
Chattanooga, Tennessee.
I've been to Chattanooga. I kind of like that. I like that better than I like Knoxville, which is where I attempted to go to school for a while. Anybody else east of Duluth? No?
Farther north.
Farther north? Oh. So that's almost impossible.
No, come on.
No.
Well, Yardley Circle.
Yeah. From?
Yardley, Saskatchewan.
All right, so you have come a ways. How many Northwestern types, by and large? That includes Americans and Canadians. Okay. Either one.
Originally,
that. How about southwestern types, especially Californians? Okay, from
Bay Area.
Bay Area.
New Mexico.
Ah, are you the Los Alamos crowd? Oh, met your boys the other night.
You should leave now.
Your girls met their boys.
Yeah, my girls met their boys. I was thrilled. I started to take the right road out of Los Alamos a couple weeks ago. You know how the bridge is out, and you got to go down through the canyon. I started to go down there, and my wife, my girl, said, "Don't do that. That doesn't look like it goes anywhere." So then I had to back up, and we've got a van and a tent trailer, so I had to back up canyon, back that thing up, turn around, and then we drove all the rest of the way out of town toward the golf course and beyond. And finally, some polite woman said, "No, that was the way to go," because we were going out and heading for Farmington by going off over the range. But it had been a long time since I'd been in Los Alamos. I enjoyed that a great deal. Some of the remarks that I'm making today are taken from this book in the library. It's always due reserve for you to plug the books in the library. This is a book entitled Healing the Planet, which is Paul and Ann Ehrlich out of Stanford. And it's subtitled Strategies for Resolving the Environmental Crisis, which means that they're doing more than just lamenting about it. They're talking about things that can be done. The main thrust isn't necessarily water resources, but they certainly touch on it. Some things come out of here. And so I would recommend this to you. It's brand new, so it is still in hardback. You won't get it in paperback yet. For light reading, I've been before I go to bed at nights, I've been reading an old friend, Edward Abbey, and in this case, Slumgullion Stew. And Edward Abbey just passed away recently, and there was a lone voice in the wilderness that was stilled when that happened. Some of you my age or just a little bit older can remember that reading Desert Solitaire was kind of the thing that you did when you were in school. And Desert Solitaire is a story of Edward Abbey's season in the wilderness at what is now Arches National Park. At the time, it was Arches National Monument. All right, so how many people have been to Arches? All right, we've got a few there. Even from northern Saskatchewan, that's a fair trip. And Abby's job there was to be the park ranger and campground superintendent, which those of you who've gone to Arches know the campground is way at the end of the line. And when it was still a national monument and a dirt road, that was quite a trip. And there's one conversation that Abby had with somebody that I'd like to relate to sort of start this all off, and it has to do with the fellow from Ohio. And he strolled into Abby's living space. He had a trailer there, sort of like the trailer that's there now for the park personnel. And the fellow from Ohio strolls in, he takes a look at that big vista out there with the LaSalles and back over toward the windows portion of Arches, and he says, "Nice country you've got here." And Abby says, "Yes." And Abby had been talking to this guy, and he knew he was from Ohio. And the guy, Nick, says, "Too bad it doesn't have more water." And Abby says, "If it had more water, it'd be Ohio." The Ehrlichs mentioned something in their book that is known to ecologists as Liebig's Law of the Minimum, stating the amount of living matter in a given environment is limited by the stock of whatever requisite of life is in shortest supply. And in the American West, in the Cadillac Desert, that's water. Let's do a short geography lesson. I love doing geography lessons. Bill's a math teacher. He doesn't like geography lessons.
I do like geography.
But you do like geography.
I love it.
Let's wander into the great state of Colorado, where my wife was born. That's why I say it's the great state of Colorado. Actually, I like Colorado just fine as well. And Denver. Start off and hit a few of the really major rivers that rise out of Colorado. What can you think of?
Colorado.
That was a gimme. Rises out of this portion of Colorado and winds its way on into Utah that way. What else?
Rio Grande,
which headwaters aren't all that far away. That's why people go to Creed and the Slumgullion Pass area, which of course ends up wandering back down through New Mexico. What else? We've got the easy ones done.
Thompson.
Big Thompson, for those of you who have spent any time close by. Big Thompson isn't one of those things, it's a household word for the rest of the world, but if you remember the Big Thompson Canyon flood back in the 70s, what larger drainage is it part of?
Probably the Platte.
It's part of the South Platte. which heads off this way. And of course, you guys all remember that because every last one of you just loves to read Michener, right? I love to read half of Michener. And it's true with almost every book that guy writes. I'll read the first quarter or the first half, at least topically, because that's when he's setting the stage. He's doing all that history. And in Centennial, he's talking about the formation of the Rockies and all that stuff. And I read that, and I mean, I'm riveted. I read that book, and it's great. And then I hit his fiction. Gag! I can't, you know, I just can't do it anymore. So I always read half of Michener. And then my wife reads the other half, so we get our money's worth out of the book. But at any rate, the South Platte and Centennial and all that sort of stuff. All right? What else?
The Arkansas?
The Mighty Arkansas, which, of course, comes out through the Canyon City area and gives you Royal Gorge, comes over here where it hits the Kansas state line and immediately becomes the Arkansas River. Okay? It's the Arkansas all the way through Kansas. Of course, it winds through Kansas, makes the big bend, then comes down here, crosses the Oklahoma line where it becomes the Arkansas again. Okay? Right now, where all these rivers ultimately end up? Where's the Rio Grande end up? Gulf of Mexico, the Arkansas. Gulf of Mexico, South Platte, Gulf of Mexico. Where's the Colorado in?
Dies.
Or dies. Sure. In the state of New Mexico, you'll have the Rio Grande wander through. Any other major rivers that rise in New Mexico? Big league rivers?
Canadian
rises here and kind of heads to Oklahoma, and the Pecos comes down, sort of comes alongside the Rio Grande. Of course, that's what makes, and any good Mexican will tell you, that's what makes some of those places in New Mexico exist in the first place. I mean, Fort Sumner, Don, Corona. I mean, this is real exciting towns. How many major rivers rise out of Utah, have their headwaters there?
Green.
Actually, it's north of that.
Wyoming.
Green comes out of Wyoming, Flaming Gorge. And the Yampa come out of here and over here, and they meet in Dinosaur National Monument, and they come down here in southern Utah and, of course, join up with Colorado in the canyonlands. There's not much in the way of any major rivers that rise out of Utah. Major rivers that rise or have their origin in Arizona. Seen the mighty Salt roll through Phoenix lately? Yeah, there's no major rivers that rise in Arizona. Of course, my favorite. How about those major rivers that rise in Nevada? There's real high. Or for that matter, yeah. Or for that matter, Southern California. Yeah, the Los Angeles River, you've seen it as you drive through Burbank, right? That big concrete conduit. Now, when you stop and think about this, here we are with Utah. Come on, magic pen works. Here we are with Utah, Wyoming. We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 U.S. states and Mexico and one river emptying into the Gulf of California for all of them. Any youngsters studying to be lawyers? You want to be a lawyer? Too bad. If you want to get a nice career as a lawyer, practice environmental law and water rights legislation, this is the place for you. Let me take you through a short history of what's gone on here. 1922, Colorado River Compact is instituted between these seven states. Gives each one of the seven states involved 7.5 million acre feet of water per year out of the Colorado River. Now, an acre foot, you have an acre, something the size of a football field, you cover it 1 foot deep in water, that's 1 acre foot. Okay, so every state gets 7.5 million acre feet Colorado River. Pretty nice, provided the Colorado River year in, year out delivers that much water. Oh, by the way, Mexico wasn't part of this. The ultimate downstream user of water was not part of the compact in 1920-22. The Mexican government wasn't exactly excited about this. So in 1940, thereabouts, we made a separate treaty with Mexico. We gave them 1.5 million acre feet per year. In 1961, we built a desalinization plant on the Colorado River for the Mexican government. Are you aware that that had happened? Did you know that one? We built a desalinization plant on the border because the water in there had something like 2,700 parts per million total dissolved solids. That's getting into the range where cows don't even care much for it, let alone people. How did that happen? In case you don't know, this is a desert, right? This is sort of a hot climate, dry. And during these years, from the 20s on, we have done things like put up Glen Canyon and Hoover Dam and formed Lake Mead. We put these dams across areas with enormous evaporative potential. Water evaporates, the remaining water is saltier and saltier so that the downstream end of it is virtually unusable. And that's why we ended up building a desalinization plant for Mexico in 1961, because the water that we were giving them, we'd agreed to give them 1.5 million acre feet per year. We just didn't tell them what kind of condition it would be in when it got there. So we built the desalinization plant. Okay, there is one river system through these seven states. There's also some fair centers of population. We've got Phoenix, we've got Tucson. Albuquerque has its own sets of problems, right? That's why you like living up in Los Alamos. Stay out of the Albuquerque problems. Lost wages out there in the desert. Of course, not to mention
Los Angeles,
San Diego, all of that, all of those millions and millions of people there. Now, here's something for you longtime Northwesterners. Let me throw out an acronym here for you so that you can see it, see if you remember this. This is NAWAPA. Does that do anything for you, Bill?
No.
Any Northwestern types who've been in the Northwest since the 60s? None of you remember the grand North American Water and Power Alliance? Don't remember that. The North American Water and Power Alliance was that project to turn the Cadillac Desert into a Garden of Eden, and how it was going to be accomplished was to divert water from virtually every major water course in Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia.
That's why Wacky Bennett Dam was north.
It's a long ways north. It's a long ways north. There was this alliance put together, formalized in the early 60s to divert water from Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia all the way into southern Arizona.
I remember that, but I don't remember the...
That's what it was called. Yeah. That's what it was called. Some of you, especially Bay Area Californians, talk to us about Northern Californians and Southern Californians.
They steal our water.
Steal your water. Talk to us about the California Water Project.
No. I think it's the Southern California Water Project.
So is the word Mulholland a dirty word in Northern California? Sure, we've all seen this.
Now we follow up I-5?
Well, Mulholland, Mulholland, for which the infamous Mulholland Highway through the Santa Monica Mountains is named, Mulholland was Los Angeles city engineer with the vision
This one built this.
Basically built the entire thing.
Yeah.
Built the entire thing to bring all of that Northern California water into Southern California via the Grand Canal project.
It started with the Owens Valley.
And in particular, the Owens Valley. All right, anybody traveled Eastern California, seen the Owens Valley? If you go from Los Angeles and you want to go skiing up at Mammoth Lakes, this is where you go. Okay. So, Owens Valley, hands. This guy's been everywhere. This guy's been absolutely everywhere. Well, what do you want to say about the Owens Valley?
It's dead.
It's dead. Sure it is. It was not once upon a time. If I say the words Sagebrush Rebellion, does that mean anything to you? The Owens Valley, once upon a time, before the turn of the century, was a very fertile agricultural valley. Runs up the backside of the Sierra Nevada of California. Never had a great amount of rainfall, but had a lot of snowmelt off the Sierra on one side and the White Inyos on the other. If you want to drive up a long valley and have spectacular mountain vistas on either side, try your luck in the Owens Valley. When you get to Bishop, you'll have 14,000 foot peaks on one side of you and on the other while you're at an elevation of about 4,000 feet. It's stunning. It's also a desert where there was not one once before. And the people who live there don't much care for that, hence the Sagebrush Rebellion, which occasionally manifests itself in vandalism to part of the water delivery system down the Owens Valley. All right, part of the point this afternoon in talking about some of this stuff is that Liebig's law here, law of the minimum, is pretty inexorable with respect to its consequences. When you start talking about going beyond a sustainable level, then you start affecting a variety of things. You affect Northern Californians in a very dramatic fashion. You've seen what happens to the ecosystems up and down the Sacramento Delta. You've seen what happens to the ecosystems in Mono Lake, for example, as a result of this kind of thing. And you have a huge number of demands on the water from all kinds of folks. Right? But even though, and I would suspect that as Northern Californians, your first inclination is, it's all those Southern Californians, and if we shut off their water, they'll all go home. You know, they'll leave Los Angeles and move away. But when push comes to shove, it is not so much population that's damaging the environment and causing so much consternation over the amount of water. Instead of population, it's what? Agriculture. And the agriculture of the Great Valley of California is far more disruptive and destructive than the number of people in the Los Angeles area. You realize that 85% of that project's waters basically ends up in the Great Valley of California, and only 15% on down into Los Angeles, you get a little better handle on the picture. But the problem with that, the problem with irrigation, for that's what it is, irrigation in arid lands, is that the Irrigation Act in and of itself is a desertification act, right? Desertification. You've heard desertification, the process, the human process of turning someplace into a desert. And you normally think about it when you think about sub-Sahara Africa and all the folks now in Timbuktu with sand dunes encroaching. By the way, even though the Europeans would deny it, the past 10 to 12 years of Landsat photographs from satellites in space, indicate desertification of both Spain and southern Italy, as a matter of fact. So it has moved north of the Mediterranean, as a matter of fact. But desertification, the process of turning an area into a desert by human activities can be accomplished in several fashions, one of which is irrigation. We'll come to that. You can do several things. You can overgraze. Talk to the African nations of Sub-Sahara about that. We don't even have to go that far. The states of the American Southwest are dramatically overgrazed. The Bureau of Land Management, the national forests. What's the common phrase that the Forest Service has for the national forests? The Wenatchee National Forest, land of all right. Land of many uses. So what do the folks in Arizona say about the National Forest Service? They'll say, Coconino National Forest, land of many abuses. Instead, there's also a certain percentage of the Arizona population that wants to change the license plate on the cars. The license plate on the car says Arizona, the Grand Canyon State. They want to change it to Arizona, the Cow Pie State. Instead. You can overgraze. We can come back to that because it's a kind of a fascinating topic in itself. You can over-cultivate. You can, where there are still some forests, deforest. And we talked a little bit about that and some stuff we were doing last week. But you can get involved in improper irrigation. Involved in improper irrigation and cause horrendous problems in very short order. This is kind of what I wanted to focus on a little bit today, because it has actually brought entire civilizations to their knees, wiped them out. Civilization on the west flank of the Andes, that nobody's sure of the age, 3000 BC, something like that. Civilization in the northwest corner of what is now India disappeared. And if we decide that we don't like Iran and Iranians, since we're the great saint to them and we wish them ill, we can be fairly successful at that, because the fertile lands of Iran are in very serious trouble in terms of their agricultural productive potential. And it works something like this. Anytime you are in a desert and in an area of high evaporative capacity, and you start putting water on the ground, so here's the ground surface, whatever it is that you're growing. And you do the kind of irrigation that goes on in the Southwest. Fortunately, most Southwestern irrigators aren't real big on the overhead systems that shoot all kinds of water out there, although we still do it in Texas. But we do flood irrigation, right? We flood the surface of the ground. And when we flood the surface of the ground, the water enters the ground top down like this. But in an area of high evaporative potential, deserts, water evaporates back out of the ground very quickly and leaves behind whatever minerals are in the water. It produces salinization of the soil. It puts salt in the soil. Okay? And especially if you produce water from below, from groundwater tables, bring it up to the surface, put it on the ground, and the groundwater mineral laden, and normally a little bit more mineral laden, then the effect is even worse by irrigating with the groundwaters, and you have salinization of your land, and most plants aren't real happy with highly saline soils. The human activity increases the desert-like nature. The agriculture activity increases the desert-like nature, making it more of a desert. and making it more difficult for crops to grow.
Traditionally, what minerals are you talking about that have a salt capacity?
Well, sodium is going to be the biggest offender by far. And actually, any one of those ones that's over there on that side of the periodic chart, the monovalent cations move fairly easily, so sodium and potassium. And then the divalents will move as well, and you can get into calcium and magnesium, those kinds of things. But the sodium and potassium in particular are very mobile. And plants aren't very good for it. All right, Californians again. The Oxnard Plain outside of Los Angeles, that's Oxnard, Ventura, on up towards Santa Barbara. If you get off of 101 and head for the beach, right at 101, you're 3 or 4 miles away from the beach, and it's a different problem, but I'll come back to that. But as you go toward the beach from the highway, you're going through all of those great citrus groves that have always been there that have been so good. And as you go closer and closer to the beach, they disappear, 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 until you get down within a mile or so of the beach, and they're growing sod, you know, for lawns. And the reason they're doing that is because the sod is the only thing that's salt tolerant enough. And in that case, the salt water is coming in from wells, and the sea has actually come in and contaminated the freshwater aquifer. But they've lost the citrus. Citrus is not salt tolerant at all. And so they're growing sod. Were you about set to?
Is that why a lot of times when you go down the Central Valley, like down I-5, moonlight stretches, they're almost white, snow white?
Exactly.
Because of the salts that have leached out.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And the Central Valley of California is a terrible place as a result of that. Also, the Central Valley of California, to bring in another problem, the agricultural practices in there tend to enhance the selenium levels in the soils, and the Kesterman Wildlife Refuge around Bakersfield has some horribly mutated ducks and other forms of wildlife as a result. It's really a problem. Really the problem. My point, though, is that the human activities like this in a desert area make it more of a desert. Make it more of a desert. Okay. So you're left with one of a couple of choices in that respect, and there have been some really amazing things suggested, like this North American Water and Power Alliance thing back in the 60s, there have been some amazing things suggested in terms of bringing water to the desert. I mean, think about it. Think about trying to have canals from British Columbia to Arizona, from Oregon. And I mean, you guys want to see the Columbia diverted? Same thing happens in what has been called the Great American Desert. And we'll hit you with a little bit of history here. Any idea who first turned the coin the Great American Desert and what he was talking about? Ring any bells for anybody? This is a little more obscure. Zebulon Pike. Pike's Peak, Colorado. Zebulon Pike waltzes across the Kansas border, although there wasn't any real border at the time. There's a big difference between western Kansas and eastern Colorado, by the way. Western Kansas looks a whole lot better than eastern Colorado. Eastern Colorado is in the rain shadow of the Rockies. And Zebulon Pike comes out of Kansas and into Colorado, and he says, this is a great desert, and he called it the Great American Desert in eastern Colorado. But in eastern Colorado, up through the Dakotas, down into the Texas Panhandle, lies the Ogallala Aquifer, one of the great groundwater resources of the continent. And the Ogallala is running dry. It's running dry because you don't have an appreciation when you're dealing with groundwater of the nature of inflow, outflow. Rivers are fairly straightforward, right? We're talking about the Grand or the Colorado flowing through those western states, and there's X number of gallons going by, cubic feet going by a certain point in time. You can sort of quantify that and deal with it. But groundwater is this nebulous sort of thing that there's water down in the hole here. And one of the things that people have a very difficult time understanding is that it still works the same way that a river does, but just on a much slower basis. You still have to worry about the amount of water that goes in, the water that goes out. And the water that's gone into the Ogallala has been going in there for a very, very long time. I mean, how much rain is there in eastern New Mexico? I mean, how many people inhabit places like Vaughan and Corona and Portales? Right? There is not much to that place. The Ogallala Aquifer, is being mined. Right, that's how geologists and hydrologists talk about it. It's being mined. In fact, there's a saying in the High Plains of Texas that this stuff is being mined as gold and sold for the price of cotton. What that means is that this stuff is being mined at a faster rate than it can ever be replenished. And in fact, it is mined so fast and so much of it has been mined that the water that is coming out of the bottom of those wells now is 10,000 years old. We can isotopically make that determination. The water is 10,000 years old. I mean, forget the stuff that was in that came in, you know, 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago. This stuff is 10,000 years old. The saturated zone of the aquifer prior to mechanized agriculture on the plains was 20 meters, 60 feet thick. It is now 3 meters thick. That's all that's left. The estimates are that 10, 20 years. Now, I don't know if you've ever been in that part of the world or not, but there are some fairly substantial places out in the panhandle of Texas, actually two, Lubbock and Amarillo. Dalhart, Pampa, a few other type places. There is a day of reckoning approaching the panhandle area of Texas and on up into the rest of the Ogallala Aquifer area that's not all that far off. And it's because we don't have this concept of sustainability. Let me tell you something else that's a problem in the American desert, that in the Cadillac Desert of the American West, that can kind of sharpen our focus on interrelationships. Let me throw this at you. The example I'll use is actually not out of the Ogallala or any of the western aquifers, but it could be. It could be out of the Ogallala. It could be out of the aquifers of the Central Valley of California, you know, anywhere in between there. But let me tell you a story about catfish. And I doubt there's no other Texans in here, right? Okay. You may not have heard this story before, but you'll get a chuckle out of it. This is a story of catfish in Texas. Okay. Here's not the Ogallala aquifer, but instead the Edwards aquifer. And the top of it is kind of a flat spot, broken up by canyons that comprise, these are trees, by the way, in case you didn't recognize it. Comprise the country just out west of San Antonio and Austin. And Edwards Aquifer is filled up to a certain level with water. So there's water filling all the pore spaces in the rock below this level. And it's the water supply source for San Antonio and Austin and all those places in between. So it supplies a lot of water for a lot of folks. Okay? Now, a couple of years ago, out west of San Antonio, and the water does actually kind of run downhill towards San Antonio, which is why there are all those springs over there in the Austin area. It's San Marcos, New Braunfels, this kind of stuff. A couple of years ago, some folks got the idea that they would put in a commercial catfish farm. Commercial catfish farm. I'm not a big catfish fan. I prefer trout up here out of these lakes in the Northwest. But some people really like catfish, and places in Texas you can go to a catfish restaurant and just do catfish.
Catfish bar.
Catfish bar. Right, it's a catfish bar. Forget the fish barn, it's the catfish bar. At any rate, these folks decided to raise catfish west of San Antonio. And there are some big rivers around there, but this wasn't on the river. They just found this flat piece of ground out here and decided they're going to raise catfish. Well, they're going to do it right. They've made a determination that catfish actually grow better if they think they're in a stream. They think they're in a stream of moving water. They like that a whole lot better than being in a tank. Okay? So some folks said, okay, that's what we'll do. we will have our catfish farm, and we'll actually just have water flow through here and make the catfish think that it's a stream. Right? Now, the way they did that was they dropped a great big well down into the Edwards Aquifer and fired it up. Okay, now, little lesson in elementary fluid dynamics and geology here. You won't have any trouble following this. When you start a well, and it doesn't matter, you can have the machinery at the top and the big fin down in here, you can put a submersible pump, it doesn't matter. But when you fire up a well, it creates what hydrologists and geologists call a cone of depression. And so the water table, instead of being this flat blue line like this, looks like this. Of course, this is a cross section. But it's a cone, you know, think about the shape of an ice cream cone.
And how deep is it?
How deep it is a function of how much water you pull out.
Yeah.
Okay. How big your well is, how fast you're running it. Okay. That's actually what makes hydrology a lot of fun, because there's a lot of interesting calculations. You'd enjoy it. As a matter of fact, you can already see trying to integrate for this area, since he's a math teacher. Actually, the rest of you do. You've taken some calculus, so you can see the integration. Or you'd like to take some calculus. Tell her she'd like to take some calculus.
I graduated from calculus.
So at any rate, the thing of it is they put in this enormous well to basically pull all the water to the surface, run it through a continuously flowing stream to raise catfish. Now, here's where we can perhaps sharpen our focus a little bit. State of Texas has what is called a rule of capture doctrine with respect to putting a groundwater well in the ground. And it sounds very simple and very straightforward. I own a piece of property. Okay, this is my property. It's 1 acre in size. I own a piece of property. I want to have a groundwater well. I am going to drill a hole on my property. I'm going to put my well down there. And then I'm going to get water out. And I'm a happy camper, right? And it's my God-given inalienable right to do this as a property owner. So, sounds straightforward, everybody, so far? Okay. Now, the thing about the rule of capture doctrine is that it fundamentally boils down to a case of being the biggest with the mostest. Because Catfish Farm's property line went from about here to here. Here's one edge of it. Here's the other edge of it. And there were some folks who had groundwater wells into the aquifer. They were just supplying their daily household needs. Those wells look like this. You see, they're in the cone. They're sucking air. There's nothing there. There's absolutely nothing there. Because this catfish farm, by putting a well on their own personal property and putting their pump on, have sucked this cone down to the point where not just two, but actually quite a number of people, remember this is a cone in three dimensions, quite a number of people were left high and dry. Groundwater is not a particular respecter of property lines. By the way, this is still law in the state of Texas, although so many people complained about it that the state water commission got an injunction against the catfish farm and to shut down this particular operation. But I think it kind of is an assessment of the entire problem in microcosm. You know, this whole business of desertification of the American West and the formation of the Cadillac Desert. Texas is having a very difficult time with this because it's an issue of individual versus communal rights. And if Texas stands for much of anything, it stands for the land of the rugged individualist. I think it provides us with some fruitful things to kind of think about here at Holden, since we're in this community. And one of my first days here, somebody that I was talking to said that, you know, the last thing you're going to find here is the rugged individualist. It's the community won't allow it. You don't just go to the kitchen anytime you want and whip something up for supper. I mean, Well, yeah, you weren't supposed to tell them that, Bill. There's a little sort of refrigerator thing that sits over on the wall, and you can actually go eat a bowl of cereal late at night, which is how all the starving college students get along here. I mean, can you imagine 18, 22-year-old college student actually just settling for three meals a day? Do you settle for three meals a day? Do you? What's self-discipline? Now, if you go over at 9 or 10 at night, you'll see some of the college-age kids having bowls of cereal over there, so you can actually do that. But this is this I think is a reflection in microcosm on the nature of a lot of things we've been talking about for the last couple weeks here at Holden, the nature of community and interdependence. I mean, this obviously is a survival of the fittest kind of situation here. The person with the biggest money puts in the biggest, deepest well, draws it down, and the other folks are literally left high and dry as a result. You'll be happy to know that most of the rest of the Western states who started out in this vein have rejected it in favor of what they call a commingled rights situation. And it is a more cumbersome type of thing. Community is more difficult in some respects than individualism. But the commingled rights approach is an approach that everyone who has a well in the aquifer is entitled, and that there must be some type of accommodation for everybody in the aquifer. And you are, in essence, looking at communal rights as being the greater good, perhaps. The corollary, go ahead, fire away.
But in the communal rights, has there been any role for the future? Yeah.
Oh, well, we've still got to tackle the future, and, well, actually, we've got to tackle the present.
Because it sounds like, I mean, if people at all have wells, have rights, but it's not working to preserve water for the future.
The water preservation for the future is not being taken care of. And therein is a larger problem with respect to the concept of sustainability. I mean, what is a sustainable? I mean, as painful as it sounds, a sustainable lifestyle in the American West doesn't really have Phoenix, Tucson, Las Vegas in its picture. We are dramatically overextended. That 1.5 million acre feet per year that's promised to Mexico. Any of you been down below Yuma in Mexico recently and seen the Colorado Delta? It's bone dry.
How many of those states actually get their 7.5 million acres?
The only states that in recent years have gotten their full complement of water have been Arizona and California. This will make Southern Californians feel good, but the other states have actually voluntarily reduced their demands. I mean, in some respects, there's not any question about it, because 7.5 million times seven states, you know, that 55 million, say, hasn't come out of the Colorado. The problem was that during the early teens and up to 20, when they were gauging the flow of the Colorado and trying to establish the amount that every state would get, those years were unusually wet throughout the Great Cadillac Desert. And so the numbers that were allowed to each state were higher than average in the first place. But so far, Arizona and California are the only ones that get their full share. And they're fighting. They've been in court recently. No Coloradoans with us, just folks who travel through. The next thing to watch for on the horizon, Denver and its growing suburbs are looking at two things. They're looking at the Alamosa Valley, which is the San Luis Valley, Alamosa in south central Colorado, which is kind of a pretty little valley, but it would go the way of Owens Valley if Denver can get their hands on it. But Denver actually has a more ambitious schedule as well. Denver wants to have rights to some of the Colorado River in Colorado, and it presently gets none of the Colorado River water. It's wanting to trade some water rights, which under the present legal system is allowed to do, to get some water off the front end of the Colorado River, which then, of course, impacts everybody all the rest of the way down the line.
Well, they got to pump it over the Continental Divide now, right?
They got to take it over the Continental Divide.
They're already doing that.
Yeah. I mean, they're already coming off the backside behind the Eisenhower Tunnel area already anyway.
I mean, there's water coming out of the Colorado going into the Rio Grande range.
Yes. Tunnels. Yeah. Right. So there is a certain diversion already.
Why the name Cadillac? Just because of the well?
Well, there's actually a couple things. One has been the wealth generated for people in that part of the world so far because they had first rights to the water. Part of that is directed at the stockmen's associations in the western states. A great deal of water in the western states in the Cadillac Desert have been used not even so much for agriculture and growing crops, but actually to take care of the cattle industry. And we could come back and touch on this at great length, but suffice it to say that there are large cattle ranches and some fairly well-to-do cattlemen. I mean, I know how that works in Arizona, having lived there in some of these states. And when you stop and think about the fact that 3%, only 3% of America's beef industry, only 3% of America's beef comes from that part of the world, west of the Rockies, basically. You know, the water demands to feed that industry for the return on it, you know, seems somewhat skewed. Part of it has to do with the fact that the Chihuahuan Desert sneaks up into Texas, and Amarillo would call itself the gateway to the West. I don't know if any of you have been in Amarillo. It's pretty exciting. But Amarillo would call itself the gateway to the West. And there's a funny fellow that lives on the outskirts of Amarillo. He lives out on the west side of town. Any of you can see his ranch as you drive down I-40. Heading for New Mexico and the Promised Land, because as you drive by, he has an unusual fence up out at the front edge of his ranch. It's each of his Cadillacs as they've been retired. And as he has retired them and bought a new one each year, cattleman and rancher, he's taken the previous year's Cadillac, gone out to the front edge of his property, bulldozed a hole in the ground, kind of at a 45-degree angle, driven last year's Cadillac into it. Jeez. So the Cadillacs stick up out of the ground at a 45-degree angle, and you can drive right down the road and see each successive year's Cadillac. The introduction to the Great American West and the Cadillac Desert.
It seems to me like Argentina and Australia have similar geography to the American West. The same situation occurring in those two areas?
Especially in Australia, they run enormous cattle operations. And Australia is a big beef producing area and has been historically, I mean, ever since the foundation of the nation. And in Western Australia, you know, they'll run cattle ranches that are 100 miles by 100 miles square. And the destruction of the vegetation, the overgrazing, has been a problem and has led to continued desertification there as well. And same kind of thing in some of the pampas, the great grasslands of Australia, of Argentina. Overgrazing there has led to a desertification process. And you know, it gives you pause to think maybe a second time about Al Pitcher's cry for eating less beef in terms of this whole desertification process. I will be happy to stick around and talk for a while. I've got just almost 5 o'clock and the bell ringing, but if you have some questions, I'll be happy to stick around and talk to you for a while about anything I've said up here, any questions brings to mind.
Are you going to talk about recovery?
Am I
recovering
going
to the desert back to, or is there a possibility of that? That's not one of your topics the rest of it?
No, the recovery and the rehabilitation of the desert,
okay.
in a certain respect, you won't see it happen. There's another ecological law that when you destroy a certain ecological niche, the one just below it is the one that comes in and takes over. And so getting it back, some of these grasslands back to a fully rehabilitated position may not happen for centuries, if ever. So, well, thanks for your time, folks. I enjoyed this. And if you want to hear a little bit about biodiversity, that's 10:45 tomorrow morning. We'll talk about that. So, thanks. Yeah, I'm jumping all over the place this week.